โอเคSo a good question to start. Is there a way to not be lazy? Yeah. ถึงใจเนาะ I try to motivate myself, but it doesn't always work. I usually get my work done, but it's always last minute. หัวเราะเห็นใจ Yeah, let's just start off with a simple observation. Now, if you live out in the countryside, say like as I have done in forest monasteries, and then you see the people going out into the fields every day, rice farming and working in gardens and so on.And some days it's very hot, and some days it's raining and miserable, and yet those people go out every single day. So is it possible that they don't ever feel lazy? Well, yeah, of course, everyone feels lazy, but they don't feel like they've got any choice, because if they don't go to their fields, then the rice may not grow, they've got nothing to eat.And they can't take care of their families. So it's a simple observation that people who are lazy feel that they have the choice to be lazy. And when you don't feel you have the choice to be lazy, you're not lazy. It's not something that you cannot overcome. So often when people say they're lazy, people are often lazy in some areas of their life.But in other areas of their life, they're not lazy. So if you know there was this sort of quality called lazy, I'm a lazy person, you'd be lazy in every area of your life. But it's obviously a matter of motivation. So if you feel it's like a matter of life and death, or whether you'll be able to put food on the table for your children, then you're not lazy. No one's lazy. So the idea is to obviously be able to use your mind and your ability to reflect and consider things to create that same kind of motivation. And so motivation is built from skillful reflection. So finding ways of motivating yourself. This is one of the essential skills that very few schools teach. You know, you're expected to motivate yourself, but not really taught it as a skill to develop. And I think it's if you have developed that as a skill, consciously consider that part of your education is the ability to sustain a constant level of effort independent of.The object of study, meaning to say some subjects will be more enjoyable than others, and even enjoyable subjects will have some parts, some topics which you're not particularly interested in. So being able to maintain a steady application independently of how you feel about what you're studying, is important.But also how you feel about it is not fixed either. You can change how you feel about something by reframing it. So when we look at something, we always approach things within a frame. So you have to, first of all, be conscious of the frame that you have created for this topic, this area of your life, and see whether it is in fact the best frame.And there may well be a better or more skillful frame in which to understand what you're doing. So the things that motivate us vary from person to person, but to try to get in touch with those things that do inspire you and uplift you, and then associate them with or find a way of framing what you're doing in the light of those values and objectives and goals that you have in your life. So it has to be the topic, the area in which you're lazy, you have to ground it within a bigger narrative or a frame or a context which overall you see as useful and important to you. And the other thing, of course, is, you know, basic time management. If you learn how to manage your time more skillfully, then you don't get that sense, oh, I've only got a very short time to do all this work, and then you feel it's a pressure on you, and you can feel depressed or intimidated, or you just won't do it altogether, and you just don't even want to think about it. Training yourself in creating a schedule for yourself and a discipline around keeping that schedule. So you're probably familiar with the idea of dividing the things you have to see to into four categories. First is urgent and important. Second is important and not urgent. Second is urgent and not. Third is urgent and not important. And fourth is not urgent and not important. Okay, so the things that are not urgent and they're not important, you put them last, not first. And the things that are both important and you have a deadline and it's urgent, then you put the first. So that's pretty uncontroversial. The second and third one may be somewhat counterintuitive in that things that are urgent, you know, they really need to be done. If they are going to be done, they need to be done within a certain time. But when you stop and think about it, they're not really that important. But because you've got this kind of time scale and time pressure, then that makes you tend to think it is important when in fact it's not. Other things are really important, but they're not urgent. Obvious example is like meditating every morning. You know, it's I would say it's very important and long term to your quality of life. But it's not like, you know, if you don't do it today or within the next week, something terrible is going to happen. And that's why you need the self-discipline and being able to stand back from what's going on in your life and see the big picture and long-term strategy for your life, not just, you know, from now until the end of term or now until the end of your formal education. What are your thoughts on the strict segregation or roles of gender in the Buddhist practice, also known as the Bluok part? Is it also known as that? I'm not sure I completely understand the question. I mean, in terms of segregation of the sexes, well, that's part of creating the optimum conditions for practice. So in a monastery or in a retreat situation, then usually people are taking the celibate vows and training, and there's nothing that can disturb the mind as easily and as violently as sexual feelings. So it just makes sense to try to minimize all occasion for those feelings to arise and disturb this effort. So, you know, we're aware, I think, you know, we're familiar with the idea of very difficult technical endeavors requiring very special environments. Obvious example, an operating theater. So there's all kinds of very special kind of artificial protocols and rules that are applied in an operating theater that are not applied in other areas of a hospital or without in general life. And similarly, when you're putting a lot of effort into formal meditation practice, you're wanting to minimize all unnecessary distractions. So this is for the duration of a time in a monastery or duration of time on a meditation retreat, and you go back to your ordinary life, and that kind of segregation is obviously not expected. So it's a temporary measure taken upon to minimize distraction and optimize the beneficial conditions. I'm not sure whether this question is also generally about role of men and women in Buddhism at large. If it is, maybe you can ask another question. I'll, you know, make that clear to me. Society has changed a lot over the years. How do you think Buddhism has adapted and will adapt? Society is always changing. Maybe we could say that the rate of change is increasing. Things are changing at a faster rate than they did in the past, perhaps. But I think that in terms of Buddhism itself, in terms of the heart of Buddhist teachings, there's no problem at all, because Buddhism is based on understanding of the nature of things and studying and learning about the nature of change and the way things change according to causes and conditions, and dealing with change wisely is very much at the heart of Buddha Dhamma. In terms of Buddhist institutions, then it's a different thing. And Buddhist institutions are prey to kind of rigidity, just like any other institution. I think in particular the Theravada Buddhist institutions, or like the Sangha, as we call it, Theravada, is perhaps particularly prone to that. And the reason being that of all the different Buddhist traditions that emerged after the death of the Buddha, then Theravada Buddhism, which is the Buddhism found in Sri Lanka, Thailand, Burma, Cambodia, Laos, South Vietnam, this school of Buddhism has always found its identity in conservatism. It's the conservative option, if you like. And it's the tradition that say we never changed anything the Buddha taught. Everything the Buddha taught we have preserved. We haven't added anything on our own authority, and we haven't taken anything away. So that's the very the Theravada Buddhist identity. So when you have that as the identity of an institution, then that conservatism is always going to be likely to tip over into rigidity and resistance to changes that might well be made or should be made. The Buddha did, in fact, foresee the challenges that would come with a changing society, and he gave what we may call a protocol, a certain principles. He said to monks that when you come into contact with something new that wasn't spoken of by the Buddha himself, there, and you have some doubts as to whether or not it's a good thing or not, or allowable for monks to make use of, then you should compare all the similar things, comparable things that the Buddha allowed, and the comparable things that Buddha disallowed or prohibited, and see which it is closest to. So for monks, an obvious one example would be car. Can a monk drive a car? Well, it's not in the Vinaya. The Buddha never forbid monks to drive cars. So how do we make a decision about whether it's appropriate or not for monks to drive cars? Well, The general opinion is that if we compare it with modes of transport and conveyances and the way that monks used to travel in the time of the Buddha, and the things that Buddha said were inappropriate, then cars are much more similar to those things the Buddha disallowed. But also, if a monk is driving a car, then there is a possibility he might be responsible for an accident and create bad karma. Or to have a car, then he would need to be filling it with petrol, and he would need insurance and so on. So it would be almost impossible for a monk who drives a car to keep the very important rules about not touching money. So driving a car involves breaking a number of other rules that are not directly related to the driving itself. So this is the way that the Buddha gave us to make decisions about changes in the society. But there can be times when there is no clear consensus, where some monks interpret it one way and some monks interpret it another way. It's really dependent on the monastic community. As if you're going to become a monk, then, you know, you choose a monastic community which has rules and procedures and standards which you feel faith and confidence in. That in itself is a huge topic, so I'll leave that for a moment. Another big question. What is the meaning of life? Ooh. So I don't think this is a very good question. I think it's a pretty meaningless question, actually. So the Buddha says there are four kinds of questions, okay? The first kind of question you can answer directly. Let's say a question like, are we in Bacchong? So I would say yes. Okay, this is a straightforward kind of yes or no kind of question. And then the second kind of question said, is Bacchong a nice place? You see, now a wise, an intelligent person wouldn't just give a yes or no answer. You'd have to say, well, it depends. In what respects do you mean? What area of life and living are you talking about? So you have to take the question apart and look at it in different from different aspects. Then the third way of answering questions is with a counter question, and that can be used very skillfully by teachers who, by answering a counter question, asking a counter question, enable the person who is asking the question originally to recognize their intention or their mistake, wrong thinking in asking the question, for instance. And the fourth means of answering question is not to answer at all, because the question is wrongly founded. And by answering it in any way, you're only going to increase the confusion rather than decrease the confusion. So I think is a better question than what is the meaning of life. It is, how do you give meaning to life? How do you create a meaningful life? Or what is a meaningful life? You say, what is the meaning of life? You're presupposing there is something called life and there is something called meaning. And life is something that possesses something called meaning. Now, these are all very questionable philosophical positions. So rather than getting into that whole realm, we say, what can you do that will give meaning to your life, that can make you feel, yeah, I have a meaningful life? What does meaning mean? What is the meaning of the word meaning, you see? That's an important one. So why do we live? We live because we were born. So then we can go back further and say, why were we born? Well, you have an immediate reason, because of your parents. But prior to that, there is the karma that you have created in past lives, which has conditioned your birth in this life. So why do we live? Then this is much closer, I think the meaning of the questioner here is much closer to my suggested question, is how do we give meaning to life? You know, does making a lot of money make life meaningful? Does it give meaning to life? Does it give purpose? Does it give weight? Can you feel proud of yourself simply because you make a lot of money? What about acting kindly and doing good actions? Is that a better way of giving meaning to life? A lot of these questions are also don't really take into account that your answer to such questions is dependent on the degree to which you have cultivated your mind. The clearer and brighter your mind is, the less clutter and confusion in your mind, then the more profound answer you will have to this question. It's not like a fixed answer for everyone. It depends on the quality of the mind, the quality of the life which is concerned. And the things that happen during our lifetime, since our birth is due to karma from previous lives, does this mean that our life is predetermined in any way? No, the Buddha very clearly rejected this idea that our life is predetermined, but we have certain predispositions, let's say, or there are things which will influence us in a certain way. But we can see that, for instance, let's say people brought up in a very difficult environment, like say in a slum, two brothers, one becomes a drug dealer, one becomes an athlete. So the conditions are exactly the same. They might even be twins, but the choices that are made are different. And although it's probably much easier to become a drug dealer than an athlete, it's not that that's forced upon you. So your karmic inheritance is like the raw materials from which you make your life. And the raw materials you make are going to condition the kind of things you can make out of your life to some extent. But it's not forcing you in a certain way. It's just a likelihood or an inclination. So this is why we develop this ability to train our mind to go beyond the immediate environment. So if we take the modern scientific consensus on the question of the importance of heredity and environment, is these days about 50-50. So obviously scientists don't talk about heredity. They don't talk about gam gao or old karma. They talk about heredity. So all these tests where they've taken identical twins with identical DNA and they've been brought up in different places and different environments, and then see to what extent their lives are similar, to what extent they disagree, and it's considered to be about 50-50. So then we could probably agree with that, I think, as Buddhists, that old karma provides maybe 50%, and what you do with your life or the environment you find yourself in, the other 50%. In the past, I've motivated myself by comparing myself with others. Is it wrong to use mana as a conceit to try to improve or motivate yourself to become a better person? No, I think in early stage, then comparing yourself with role models and trying to emulate role models is a skillful thing to do, and people have been doing this forever, and that's part of the role of a teacher or a spiritual teacher or any kind of leader is to inspire people to want to follow in their footsteps. So in the beginning, it can be, I want to be that person or I want to be like that. But as you go on, then you become more confident, in your own path, and you begin to see that there are always going to be, certain ways in which you differ from your heroes, and often you find that maybe your heroes are not so heroic as you thought they were in the first place, and that's something everyone has to deal with. It begins with that, like our first real heroes are parents. They start off as being gods, and then they become heroes, and then as we grow up, we begin to see that they're not perfect, they're not heroes. And we all have to deal with a certain amount of disappointment in our parents. And that's part of growing up. And we love them anyway. And we appreciate everything that they've done for us. But we can't put them back up there like gods and heroes as we did when we were small children. And some people get angry with their parents because they're not the gods or heroes that they would like them to be. But that's not fair on our parents, is it? So with heroes, it's more a matter of seeking to emulate the good qualities that people have, and not making things too personal. You probably remember a few years ago now, where a very famous Japanese monk, Ajahn Kawisako, he disrobed, and people Buddhists all over Thailand were very upset, and that obviously his closest disciples particularly so. So I was asked to go to give a talk and give some Gamlang Jai to all his Luksits, because I knew this monk very well since I was first in Thailand. So, the gist of what I said to these people was that, what is it when you look up at somebody and you compare and you think they're so worthy of love and respect and emulation? What is it really that inspires us? It's not the person, but it's the qualities that we see in the person. So we say, oh yeah, I respect that person so much because they're so kind and so wise and so, so much patience, for instance. But what we really appreciate is wisdom and kindness and patience. So, people who have led good lives or exemplary lives are like vessels in which those qualities are very clearly seen. But if those vessels break or disappear, then the things that were placed in those vessels, they don't disappear. They're still the same. So there's no less wisdom or kindness or patience or whatever in the world when a great being dies, or when somebody who's formerly seen to be an exemplary monk, gives up the monk's training and hurts a lot of people in the process. So there is a difference between seeing qualities in other people. You say, when we say you want to be, compare yourself with them, don't compare it as of me and that person, but you could say develop quality like the wisdom that I have now and the wisdom of that person. I would like to develop the wisdom in my heart to reach the level of that person. Or he's so peaceful. He has so much inner peace, and I don't have very much inner peace. Or how can I develop my heart so that this rather confused and unpeaceful heart could be as peaceful as his or her heart? So this is a way where you're comparing, but you're comparing qualities and you're not allowing the sense of self and conceit to become too strong. Okay. What are the levels of meditation? Sometimes if I'm asked what level I am at, and I don't understand what it means. So you can tell them you're on the confused level of meditation. Don't worry about this, and don't, the person who asks you is, I don't think is very, knows very much about meditation either. It's not a matter of gaining things and gaining levels, and those are just labels. When you're experiencing something in meditation, you don't experience it as a level. You have different things arising, passing away, not arising, not passing away. You may at some other point be able to give a name to that, but it's not really important. As my teacher, Lumpo Cha, said, it's, you know, you eat an apple, you know. He said sometimes he went over to England and he was eating fruits and he didn't know their names. He's never eaten them before, but he knew what color the fruit was and knew the texture of the fruit, knew the taste of the fruit. So he knew all the important things, but he didn't know the name of it. So you don't have to think of in terms of levels. And it's especially the case because there are different groups, you know, they have different ideas of what the levels are anyway. So you have like the Vipassana, the Burmese influenced Vipassana systems, which have like 16 levels, and you have this level and that level. It's very confusing. So don't worry about it. Just know, if you've got, the hindrances in your mind or not. You remember I told you about those five hindrances? Is there this desire and indulgence in thoughts dealing with form, sounds, odors? Are you indulging in thoughts of anger and aversion? Is your mind dull and depressed and lazy? Is it full of agitation and worry and anxiety and doubt? Then that's the work you have to do. So you're on the level of hindrances, and what you want to be doing is the level beyond hindrances. So that's one way of talking about levels, which is reasonably harmless. In meditation, when mental states like anxiety, anger, etc. arise, what should we do? So today I've been emphasizing this, creating this new way of relating to your mental world, to your experience. Like the habitual way of relating is to become one with them, to identify with mental states. So an anxious mental state arises and the non-meditator says, I am anxious. Or a state of depression arises. I am depressed. Yesterday I was anxious. Today I'm depressed. And tomorrow I hope I'll be happy. So these are all states of me, who I am. But what you're trying to develop in meditation is this clarity of awareness where you see that anxiety, depression, pleasure, all mental states are simply transient, impermanent, and conditioned mental states that arise and pass away. So the moment if you have a mental state and you grasp onto it and you indulge in it or you make a lot out of it, you identify with it, you lose your ability to see its true nature. Similarly, if you react to something with aversion and fear and I don't want this, go away, Similarly, you lose your ability to see it clearly. For when you can establish this firm and stable clarity and sense of knowing and mindfulness, then you can see it's just that. It's just something that arises and passes away. So this is the skill that we're developing in meditation, the skill to refrain from our habitual tendency to grasp on to the things that go through our mind. So we can compare our mind to the sky, and the things that occur in our mind are like clouds and planes and birds and whatever. So we have to see, yeah, the sky is the sky, and a cloud is a cloud, and a bird is a bird, and not get them confused. And this is basically what we're learning to do in meditation. Yesterday, you kindly explained that inner resources could help to let go of negative feelings and mental states. Would you please kindly explain in more detail? Yes, so I was talking about four kinds of effort we need to make in our lives. And the first kind of effort is to protect the mind from these negative feelings. So this is obviously the best option. You know, it's not like how do you deal with negative feelings like this, like that. You know, there are means of dealing with negative feelings, but if you can prevent them arising in the first place, so much the better. And for this, you need this mindfulness, awareness, patience, and all these virtues which have to be cultivated systematically. And then you feel when they have that kind of mindfulness, it's like you're invited, rather than being forced to give rise to a negative feeling. So if somebody maybe says something unkind to you before, and then you know without thinking, you know you're upset. You say something unkind to them in return. Or you feel sad or angry, or you burst into tears or whatever because of that unkind, those unkind words. But when you've developed this inner stability of mind, the mind just doesn't jump out like that so easily. It's just stable there. You know, it's not just like floating on the water. They can go this way and that way. It's like it's got an anchor. And then somebody says something unkind, and you recognize that was unkind. You know, and then you realize you could, if you wanted to, take that personally. You could be hurt, you could be angry, but it's a choice you make. It's not something that is forced upon you by that person's words. You know, when we're angry and sad and depressed, all these things, we make a choice. We're not really conscious of it, but there is a choice involved in allowing those negative feelings to take over our mind. And we can develop the ability not to take that option. You can just be aware. And, you know, so after a while, if you become more skilled at this, it's very, very joyful. you know, so, you know, like in cartoons where maybe they fire a gun, you know, and the bullets just go in and go out the other, and they just keep running, you know, like in a cartoon. It's a bit like that, you know. Somebody, it's like some people fire bullets, and you just, oh, that went right through my body and out the other end, and I didn't feel anything. And then that feels great. And so, you know, as your mind becomes stronger, then things that formerly would have made you suffer a lot hardly make you suffer at all. Or not at all. There's no suffering. Because you know how to deal with these things now. Your mind is not so, just like a butterfly, or just like a candle in the wind or something, like, you know, the slightest gust of wind and the candle blows out. You know how to take care of the flame, take it out of the wind. But all these things, it's simply a function of systematic training. It's not something mystical and weird and wonderful. It's every bit as mundane as learning how to play the piano or anything else, but it's in a slightly more refined and a more subtle realm. But principles of training are very similar. You just have to keep doing it again and again and again and again until you get better at it. I am wondering when and why did you decide to become a monk? Okay. So this is not the first time I've had this question. So I give like very short answer. So when I was a boy, I was ill a lot of the time, so I spent a lot of time by myself and liked to read and think about life and, in a way it's probably quite unusual. My family, was, a secular family, not particularly, Christian. I myself, rejected Christianity, but it didn't make any sense to me from about age of eight, I would think, when I first, it doesn't make any, I remember this because there was a TV crew who came to the school for a religious program, and I had this, one part of me wanted to be on TV, and one part of me thought the whole thing was ridiculous, so I can remember this kind of conflict in my mind. So, when I was a teenager, I had a lot of questions about, the most important one was, what is a good way to live life? Or what's the best way to live your life as a human being? And then I realized that was, assuming that you could make value judgments and you could say some lives are better than others. So the question is, what criterion would you use to make that kind of, value judgment? And I was interested in the world and why there's so much suffering and injustice and war and conflict and so much unhappiness and mental illness and all these terrible things that go on in the world. And my question was, does it have to be like this? Does the world have to be this utter mess? Or is there some way to make the world a better place? And if there is a way to make the world a better place, what is your responsibility as a human being to contribute to that betterment of the world? So I had a lot of questions like this, with my particular personality, I read a lot of books, and eventually came across a book on Buddhism, and it made complete and absolute sense to me. It wasn't like a Eastern philosophy, something strange, unusual, it just seemed absolute common sense. And it answered all of my questions, to my satisfaction. And, my conclusion from those first years of study was that, the world is such a mess and people are so unhappy and create unhappiness and suffering for each other because they don't understand themselves. And through lack of understanding of themselves, all kinds of defilements arise in their mind, which cause suffering for themselves and for others. So the effort to purify the mind of defilements and to cultivate wisdom and compassion and inner freedom, and then share that knowledge with other people. That was my conclusion as the best way to live life as a human being. So I, by this time I finished, I was approaching the end of high school. I done my A-levels a year early, so I was 17. I went to work, saved some money, and then set off to India. I was always fascinated with India since I was a child, and most of the way I hitchhiked, and I hitchhiked through Turkey and Iran and Pakistan, and hitchhiked all the way around India, and sometime on trains, but a lot of time on trucks, and visited all kinds of religious centers, and also did a fair amount of TO, and looking for excitement and experience. And then I thought, I found that the overland trip on the way hitchhiking was not as tough as I thought. I wanted to test myself a bit more. So I had a Buddhist book, and in it the abbot of the monastery was teaching the monks, and he said, don't be so greedy for requisites and robes and food. And if you have the barami, then these things will just come by themselves. You don't have to struggle. And I thought this was the most interesting and fascinating idea I ever come across. So I thought, let's see how much barami I've got. Let's see if I can hitchhike from Pakistan to England with no money. So I had $10 left of my savings, which I put in a sock, and set off from Pakistan with no money at all. And I had all kinds of adventures, and eventually got as far as Turkey. So I crossed a few thousand kilometers, and then I was completely destitute. I had no money. I lost my passport. I was ill. I had dysentery. I was kind of at the end, and I got back to Tehran, and I was sleeping. I was sleeping in a little soi behind the French embassy, between a parked car and the wall. And I knew of this bean curry shop where you get for one rial, you could get like a big bowl of curry of bean soup, and then you get as much bread as you can eat, so you can get full with almost no money. So I had a reel someone had given me, and as I was walking along the road, this teenage boy saw me, and he said, where are you from? I said, England. He said, would you like to come and live in my house and teach me English? And I said, yes, okay. So I followed him home, and I was adopted by an Iranian family, and lived with them, and made some money, and taught English, and worked as a stretcher bearer for a private ambulance company, and went back to India. And this time just went to meditate, and spent 6 months in various places with meditating, living like a life more or less like a monk. And then it was time to go back to England and tell my parents I wasn't going to university, and decide what I wanted to do with my life. And when I eventually got back to England, I signed up for a meditation retreat in Kent, in southern England, and the teacher had been a monk in Thailand for some years. And when he told gave his talks in the evening, he talked about when he was a monk, a Tudong monk, in a forest monk in Thailand. And I thought, yeah, this is exactly what I've been looking for the past 2 years. So I decided to become a monk in Thailand. And while I was preparing or saving some money for a plane fare, I heard about Ajahn Sumedho and his group in London, who were disciples of Ajahn Chah and looking for a place to build a monastery. And I went and visited them, and I was inspired, and I spent a few months with Ajahn Sumedho, during which time I learned a lot about Ajahn Chah. And then in November of 1978, I flew to Thailand and went up to Ubon and became a disciple of Ajahn Chah, and I've been here ever since. That's the short version. All right. Oh, it's nearly time for your lunch. I'll do one more question. I have a friend who is an outcast. Wow. I tried to give her advice in order to fit in. Since we all have 3 years of college together, it would be great to be in good terms with others. However, she doesn't seem to show any improvement and repeats the same mistakes. Should I keep helping her or let her face the consequences of her actions? Yeah, I don't really have enough information in this question to give a very good answer, I don't think. But I think questions that come up in my mind reading this question is, does she want to be an outcast? Is she happy to be an outcast? Does she delight in being different from everyone else and, you know, like to be a rebel in that way? Basically, is she happy with the way things are right now? And if she's not, has she any kind of insight into the ways in which she is contributing to the problems she's facing and the difficulties? Does she, you say she's not improving or she's repeating the same mistakes. Does she consider them to be mistakes? Sometimes, some things we think people make mistakes and they're quite happy with it. They don't think it's a mistake at all. So before you can help somebody, they have to recognize that they have a problem and they have to ask, or they have to show some desire for some assistance. If she is really acting in a very selfish, self-indulgent way or taking advantage of you as a friend, and this relates to answer a question yesterday in the afternoon, then that always helping someone just to indulge themselves is not actually being a good friend to them in the long term. So because I don't know exactly, you know, the details of her behavior and what the mistakes she's making and what the consequences of her actions would be, I don't really feel confident of saying much more than that. Okay, so that's the morning. You want to say something? Okay, so that's the morning session, and I apologize we didn't fit in your second meditation session, but so many questions, and we'll continue later on. So for the time being, well, we can stop.